You are listening to Radical Minds on WHPK 88.5 FM Chicago, the Pride of the South Side. Also found online at www.platypus1917.org/radicalminds. Following is an interview conducted by Aaron Haygood and Stephanie Gomez of the Platypus Affiliated Society on June 4th, 2018 with David McReynolds. David McReynolds is an ex-member of the Socialist Party USA and a longtime member of the War Resisters League.
We are with David McReynolds for Radical Minds. And so the first thing I kind of wanted to ask you is maybe if you could, you know, you have kind of a lot of experience on the left, and if maybe you could tell us a bit about like your politics and your political experience kind of to introduce yourself.
I've been active in the socialist movement since 1951, when I joined the Socialist Party, ran for president twice on their ticket, ran for Congress and the governor, but I resigned from the SP maybe a couple of years ago. I do belong to DSA and to a group called the Committees of Correspondence. I also joined the pacifist movement in 1948-49, and have been active in that and worked for the War Resisters League for about almost 40 years until I retired in 1999.
When did you join the DSA? Just curious.
Pardon?
When did you join the DSA?
That's a minor funny story. I joined it some years ago. There was a multi-split in the Socialist Party. It split three ways in 1972. One group, headed by a guy called Max Shackman, who's now dead and was very right-wing, organized, what did he call it, Social Democrats. That's gone out of business, but that was one third. One third followed Michael Harrington and set up the Democratic Socialist Organizing Committee, which became DSA. And the third group was the Socialist Party, which reorganized in 73. Anyway, there was a motion at one of the SP conventions way back then to make membership in DSA incompatible, which I thought was silly. I did not agree with Harrington. I thought he was wrong on the issue of Vietnam. But I also thought it was just silly to make it incompatible. So I said, okay, I'm going to join DSA, and if you want to expel your candidate for president, you can do that. And I joined sort of then and kept up the dues over the years. I'm very excited by the shift recently and the growth of DSA. It's really significant now. But I was just a nominal member for many years. Yes.
So you kind of mentioned Vietnam. I was wondering why exactly did the Socialist Party split up into those different groups?
The Socialist Party, which was the inheritor of Norman Thomas, or inherited his tradition, had really sort of come to the end of the line during World War II. The Communist Party grew during that time because the U.S. was allied to the Soviet Union, so it made joining the Communist Party sort of respectable in an odd kind of way. And that stopped very soon after the war when the McCarthy period began, but there was a time when the CP was fairly strong. But the SP, which had a mixed position on World War II, the pacifists in the SP didn't support the war, others did. And the great surge of American radicalism had really ended with the war. The war, which is hard to understand now because we're living through so many wars, but World War II was an extraordinary event, a kind of total war that everyone was involved with everywhere in the country, unless you were opposed to the war, and that was fairly rare. And so it didn't really allow, there's lots more seltzer if you want to finish that and start another glass.
Oh, I'm good for now, thank you.
There really were no groups of dissent. They sort of diminished. The Communist Party behaved, the SP was quiet. And by 1945-46, when the war ended, the SP, which had really been quite significant in this country, had a large membership and had Norman Thomas as a spokesman, really never regained its strength. Now, we thought at the time, as you will find out being young, that you often think where you are now is where you're going to go. And so we were thinking in 1950-51 that we were joining a group that was really the same as the one that had been so large. We didn't realize it was diminishing and sort of vanishing. I worked at that time because the SP was so small, maybe 1,000 members, to bring in a group called the Independent Socialist League, which was a reformed Trotskyist group, which claimed that it believed in democratic socialism. And I thought if we brought them in, we could bring in many of the kids were going to the New Left and didn't have a home, who eventually ended up in SDS. But my hope was to create a political home and to bring in the people leaving the Communist Party. There was a major split in the Communist Party at that time in 1953 over a speech by Khrushchev to the 20th Congress, in which he admitted that the Soviet Union had lied, that the record was terrible, and it had a devastating impact on the worldwide communist movement. Sort of like being told after you've worked with your computer, and the computer suddenly flashes a note saying, you've been off on everything that I've said by 10 digits. I mean, what do you do? You thought this was total truth, and suddenly it's very shocking. Mm-hmm. So there were splits in the communist movement, and I hoped to bring some of those people in. They weren't bad people. But what happened was that Shachtman had his own view of taking over the Socialist Party, which he did, and that came to a climax in 1972. By then I had resigned because the party had given critical support to the Vietnam War, which I thought was impossible. But that was Michael Harrington's position, and I thought it was terrible. And so I had resigned in 71. But there's a convention in 72, and at that convention, Shachtman has the majority of delegates, and he changed the name from Socialist Party to Social Democrats USA. And Harrington, who had been outmaneuvered, split to form the Democratic Socialist Organizing Committee, which became DSA. And those of us in the left wing and the old guard reorganized as the Socialist Party 1973. So the reason for the three-way split was the fact the modified Trotskyists had taken over the party with a very conservative point of view. And the better element of Marx's people left, and almost all of the old guard left. And that's what happened in 72. Let me take a cough drop, see if I can talk without. Go on and ask your next question.
So I'm kind of interested in what you talked about with the New Left, how you wanted to make a home for a lot of the New Left in the Socialist Party. I think a lot of times when people talk about the New Left, there's like this idea that it was some sort of kind of high watermark of politics, but then at the same time, like from our perspective now, it does seem to be kind of part of this gradual decline of the left, I suppose. So I was wondering, you know, what for you was the significance of the New Left? Like, what was it, you know, were there gains? Was it kind of a good thing? Do you think that there were missed opportunities? I wondered if you could go into that maybe a bit.
Well, the New Left was a major development. And Shaman, what do you want? You want to sit there and listen? If you go back to that period, the old left was really finished. The Communist Party, after the Khrushchev revelations in 53, had lost its magical power. The Soviet Union no longer was in charge of all the communists in the world. There had been a split in the world movement between China and Russia. At the same time that the old left really had disintegrated, the SP was pretty much gone, the CP was shattered, you had this extraordinary wave starting in 1955 of the civil rights movement. And Bayard Rustin, who was my boss at the time, and I worked under Bayard for some years, Bayard made the point, and it was a very good point, that the American society at that time in the early 50s under Eisenhower was stagnant, calm, there was no movement, the Cold War was going on and no objection to it, segregation in the South there unchallenged. And suddenly if you think about a piece of steel like 1 inch thick and 10 feet wide and someone hits it, it vibrates everywhere. And that's what Montgomery, Alabama did. It shook up all of American society. And people in the North felt, well, if they could do this, we can do things. So there was a movement in the civil rights movement in the North, sane nuclear policy organized against the nuclear testing. And you had a general sense of vibration that was happening. But the New Left was made up of kids who had no adult group to go to. We had failed them. And so they formed SDS. They were very, very important. They organized the first large-scale demonstration against the Vietnam War in 1965, I think. Tragically, they were divided and shattered by the effort by the Maoist group to take control and had a very sectarian line, and it destroyed SDS. And it split. Among other things, it ended up with the... What am I thinking of?
Weather
Underground, yeah. Mm-hmm. Came out of that as a very left-wing group. And it was the effectively destroyed the New Left, but it had been a very powerful group. There. Anyway.
Well, he looks so young. Yeah. Young and beautiful.
So, that leads to whatever the next question is.
Yeah. What do you mean when you say that you all had failed the New Left? Like, what specifically? When you said that you all had failed the New Left, what do you kind of mean by that?
Well, in the 1930s, if you were a young person, you could join the Socialist Party, or you could join the Communist Party. There were two well-organized adult groups. But by the 1960s, those groups didn't exist. So if you were a young person, where did you go? The sense of a direction and meaning was lost, and you were left with the New Left to find your own way.
So do you think that that was kind of, I mean, obviously you had like McCarthyism and then the breakup of the Communist Party intervening in that period, but do you think that there was something that, you know, some way that organization could have weathered that, or were they kind of doomed?
No, they were burned up. I'm leaving aside a discussion of the Trotskyists, who were not relevant, despite their damage to the Socialist Party, their one contribution. One of the problems, there are two, at least two problems. One was that the Communist Party, and with it all groups that take a Leninist position or a Trotskyist position, believe in the vanguard theory, and the vanguard theory is there's one party or one group that is leading the mass of people. There can't be two vanguards, only one vanguard. So any other group which is saying that it's leading the struggle is the enemy and has to be attacked. There can be only one vanguard. So the Communist Party and all of the Trotskyists, infamous with a number of multiplication of Trotskyist groups, are all fighting for the role of the leader of the vanguard. That was a fatal mistake by the Leninist movement. The Socialist Party was really haunted by anti-communism, not from McCarthy at all, but from our experience back to 1917, when the split occurred. It was a very bitter split. And I don't think you can grasp from here how damaging anti-communism was. That we had been united in a struggle to overthrow capitalism, but the nature of what happened in the Soviet Union was so terrible, on the one hand, really so terrible, that it made any attempt to defend the Soviet Union impossible. On the other hand, there were certain historic inevitabilities about what happened in the Soviet Union that after the revolution occurred, there were two views. Trotsky had one and Stalin another. They're both right in an odd way. Stalin felt there could not be a world revolution at that time. And he was right, that what you had to do was to defend the worker state, the first worker state. That's my class. And that meant industrialization, building up a military machine, and changing Russia from being a peasant economy to being an industrial economy. Trotsky argued for a world revolution and said, if you focus only on Russia, you're going to have a militarized dictatorship isolated from the world. Now, they're both quite right. Trotsky's analysis was absolutely correct, but a world revolution was not possible, and there he was wrong. Stalin was right that the worker state needed to be defended, but inevitably became. So both groups have really been destroyed by their internal contradictions. The Soviet Union, which did some good things, and I think it is very hard for Americans to have any grasp of what World War II meant. There were about 27 million Russians who died. One out of every 10 Russians was killed. And that leaves you with a large number of wounded that become a burden on society, of orphans who've lost their parents, and of women who have no husbands. I mean, it's very hard to conceptualize what life was like in 1946 when the war was over. And the war had destroyed all of Russia from a line from Leningrad in the north through Moscow down to Shaman, come here. Down to Stalingrad. And everything west of that was destroyed. Every factory, every airport, every dam, every railroad station, all the housing was destroyed. I mean, think about, you know, what this meant, so that we've never really grasped what the war meant to Russia. Doesn't justify Stalin at all, but it is important to see that. What was the point I was making? I'm not defending Stalin, I'm trying to explain the complexities. I mean, Stalin entered the Hitler-Stalin Pact, for example, because the West had turned him down when, because he was aware that Germany was going to attack, he went to the West and asked if they would form an alliance against Hitler. And they said no. And so Stalin, having been turned down by the West, then signed the infamous Hitler-Stalin Pact. Well, we didn't really give much alternatives to him. So I'm just explaining how tragic life was in a way. And Stalin certainly was barbaric. But the hatred of what he had done could demoralize people who should not really have made that their life's work, anti-Stalinism. So we had been destroyed by anti-communism, really very badly hurt by it. And the communist side had been hurt badly by the vanguard theory. At UCLA, when I was a student there, the Communist Party cell put out word that kids should not come to my apartment down by the beach because I worked for the FBI or the dean's office. I mean, that was really sort of nasty. And once a couple of kids who had been in the Communist Party but joined us when they realized the communists were not for artistic freedom, but they thought I was too anti-communist, and I was. They said I ought to get to know them, and they took me to a party that the communists were having. All young people like yourselves. Well, within 20 minutes of my arriving, the party ended. Everyone got their coats and left because they were afraid to be in the same room with someone who was clearly working for the FBI. Oh, wow. Do you see the the paranoia on both sides? And I had a struggle, which I think I won, mainly because I'm a pacifist. But it's worth telling the story. We had a student group of young pacifists, and Dorothy Healy, who was the chair of the Southern California Communist Party, and had been one of those indicted under the Smith Act, but not jailed, had come to our youth and said she wanted to have a discussion between the Communist Party and the young pacifists. And so they'd come to me as kind of the elder statesman and said, what should they do? I said, well, tell Dorothy, yes, we'll have that discussion, but tell her that I will speak for our side, because you will see that she won't agree to the discussion. I was wrong. She agreed. we had the discussion in a basement in Pasadena, about 20 people on both sides. They didn't say anything, peace and friendship, nothing political. One of their people called me a couple of days later and said they hadn't realized that we believed the things that they had talked about. They'd like to have another discussion. I said, okay, but you have to say something. You can't just say peace and friendship. And maybe it would be easier if just two or three of us met, and so you don't feel you're exposing people. Mm-hmm. And he said, okay. So we met with Dorothy Healy and the editor of the Communist Party Weekly, and a Quaker, and a fellow member of the Socialist Party, myself. And in the discussion, my fellow socialists talked about the need for civil liberties for everyone, including Joe McCarthy. And Dorothy turned to the one of those with us who was a quasi-Trotskyist and said, Ted, I understand why they believe this, because they're bourgeois. But you claim to be a Marxist. How can you defend freedom for the McCarthy? And I relaxed, because it was the first honest word I'd heard from the communists in all those years. And Dorothy and I became friends, and I helped set up a meeting, a debate, before I left California. And got to be on good terms with some of those in the Communist Party, up to their split in the end of the 90s, when I had all the internal documents about what was happening when they split. So I was a little bit exempt from it, but I certainly was a party to it and affected by it and damaged by it. Both sides were damaged by preconditions that were set starting way back in 1917.
So what about Marxism? Because I think this has come up a lot, like that, okay, there are these Trotskyists and they're kind of causing a problem, and then you also have, you know, the Maoists who are taking up some other version of Marxism and led to the split of the SDS. Do you think it was a good thing, a bad thing? Is there, like, a place for Marxism?
I am a Marxist, a democratic Marxist, but I'm not well read in Marx. I've never read Das Kapital. I've picked it up from the people I followed. I do believe that the material environment shapes our consciousness, that if you're born into poverty, your views of life are shaped by that. If you're born in Japan, your views of the world are shaped by that culture. The people are not such free agents as they think. They're shaped by the material environment. And I think that whoever controls the means of production does control the society. And how you manage to transfer that to a social ownership is very hard to work out. But I'm not a scientific Marxism, and I think that's nonsense, because Marxism was developed at the time in history when the physical sciences had taken control. And we were able to predict eclipses. We could carry out experiments and duplicate them anywhere in the world, get the same result. And the impact of the physical sciences was enormous. And science became a kind of religion to people at that time. And so if you look at the social movements, they were eager to be called scientific. They didn't want to be just considered ordinary movements. So you had scientific socialism, you had political science, which is not a science at all. You had sociology, which is not a science, but goes by that name. None of those are real sciences. They can't duplicate precisely the same thing. They can't predict the future precisely. But Marx chose that word to define his movement as opposed to the utopianism which had come before him. And on that I agree with Marx. But I think Marx is very wealthy in terms of ideas. He's a major intellectual power in the world, not just in the West. I just regret that people became too attached to the idea of scientific socialism and overlooked some of the humanist aspects of Marx's earlier writings. But I think the movement is healthy if it has a good number of people in it who have some idea what Marx is talking about. Not orthodox Marxists, but some idea. But I don't think everybody has to be a Marxist, and a strong movement can be built with lots of different views, Christian, Judaic, Buddhist.
So I guess I wanted to ask you about, so like for example, there's this letter that Marx writes to one of his friends where he says that, you know, his one kind of original discovery was the dictatorship of the proletariat, and obviously this is like an idea that was taken up by orthodox Marxists, especially in 1917, but also all sorts of Marxists in the 20th century, and, you know, who also emphasized like a need for a party. Do you think that, you know, a party is useful for making socialism, that it's necessary? Do you think we need something like the dictatorship of the proletariat, or what is it? I guess I'm asking if you can elucidate maybe the question
yes
of how
no.
we get, yeah.
First, we do need an organizing force. The Socialist Party or a socialist movement, if it's not too dogmatic, is very crucial for holding people together and directing the struggle. We're up against the state, the CIA, the FBI, the organized power of the Koch brothers, and so on. So we need some kind of movement, and that's a party or an organization. It doesn't have to run candidates. So yes, we need that. But Marx, by dictatorship of the proletariat, was really not talking about what Lenin ended up adopting. He meant, and it was a bad choice of words on his part, that up to that point, the ruling class, which ran things, even if it had a democratic facade, was really a kind of dictatorship of one class. Workers did not control the press, the radio, television. Those were run by people with money. You can't start a newspaper if you don't have money. And what you have is what can be called a dictatorship of the middle class. Free, yes, but not that free. You can try to exercise that freedom and you see how fast the limits are put down on you, what you face in terms of legal restraints. But he said that the dictatorship of the proletariat would be more democratic, broader based. It would mean the workers would dictate the politics. And he didn't have in mind what Lenin set up, which was an actual dictatorship with the police force. That wasn't what Marx had in mind. And so there's a lot of confusion about what he meant by it. But he did mean that there would have to be a willingness to prevent the middle class from regaining power. And
to relate to that question, because you brought up like that there does need to be some sort of party or organization. And I was wondering if we could talk about the DSA, since it's something you've been in, something that you've kind of at least watched for a long time now, and since it's, you know, the largest organization on the left now. So I guess I was wondering, maybe before we talk specifically about that, is there a difference between like a party and an organization? Like, what type of organization are you talking about, and is the DSA kind of similar to what you have in mind?
I would use party, really, for the organized center of a movement, whether it ran candidates or not. And DSA would fit my definition of a party, although I think it's not going to run its own candidates. And DSA is formed these days by the kids who were involved in the Bernie Sanders campaign. and they found a new place to go, and it was DSA. And they may eventually decide to run candidates. You can run candidates in some areas and not others. Here in New York, the Lower East Side, where I ran for Congress a couple of times, and got 5% of the vote in 68. The Village Voice gave me their endorsement. It was the height of the Vietnam War, so it was possible to run a political campaign. But we had no thought of winning the election at all. But at the same time, I found in this area where we lived that the city council person from this area is in the Democratic Party, runs on the Democratic Party ticket. And she was for many years, she's now gone, I'm pretty sure a communist working through the Democratic Party, I'm pretty sure she was. Very militant, always a lone wolf on New York City Council. And she lost an election because we didn't really get out and work for her. And we got a Republican and found out under Giuliani how dangerous it was to have a Republican in that race. And so we a lot of us, supported the Democratic candidate for city council, who was a Puerto Rican lesbian, probably out of the Puerto Rican Communist Party. And it's a left seat here, but it's in the Democratic Party. So in some cases, people on the left have supported Democrats. In some cases, they run independents. In some cases, they do something else entirely on election day.
So when you see, like, somebody now who calls themselves, like a young person who calls themselves a socialist or a democratic socialist, do you think that they're kind of in the tradition of the SP and like the work you've done in any way? Do you think that they're related? And
Yeah, I do. I think that part of a tradition of democratic organized alternatives.
Do you see any differences in like the way that you organized back during your time in the SP and how people are organizing in the
DSA? Oh, yeah, sure. I mean, I think the SP was fixated on running candidates. And I think one of the problems we've got in this country, and I've never worked it out myself in a clear way, is that the country really, in some ways, is a two-party country. And minor parties, and I'm old enough to looked at a lot of them, have all been defeated. You can go back and look at everything from Teddy Roosevelt to Debs, everything, George Wallace, Henry Wallace, all of them, without exception, have been defeated. Have not been able to build an ongoing national structure. And every time people thought they could, they would build a new third alternative, every time people have ended up going to the Democrats or the Republicans, because the moment a movement gains strength, the Democrats or Republicans will adopt the key points in order to win them back. And we're stuck with that in an odd way. We're a parliamentary system. I'm sorry, not a parliamentary system. We're basically not open to several parties contesting in the Congress. We're open to two parties. Even though they're very different, even though the two parties, if you examine them closely, are in fact more than two. You have the Democratic Party under Roosevelt. You had the Southern Democrats, who were racists, believed in lynching, segregation. And then you had in the North the big city Democrats and the trade unions. They combined to run the country for all of FDR's time. Half of them racist, violent, segregationists, half of them progressive in the same party. So you really had two parties, a Southern Party and a Northern Party. The Republicans also have the moderate Wall Street people in New York and the East Coast. And then the fundamentalists that you find in the Midwest or the mountain states that back Trump. But they work within the framework of the Republican Party.
So do you think that the DSA has been or will be able to kind of avoid this dynamic you're talking about, where different movements that you see as like kind of challenging, like the Democratic Party, for example, kind of get sucked back in?
They could, yeah. It depends on how mature their leadership is, how much they can avoid infiltration by small groups that want to take control of DSA. Which see DSA as a good thing if only they could take charge of it. They need to maintain a broad outlook to do this, and I don't know if they can. I hope they can. I've been very impressed with the DSA kids that I've encountered here on the East Coast.
So you talked about kind of how it will be necessary, like to make the revolution, it would be necessary to be able to kind of take some sort of power, right, so that you can kind of deal with, you know, the middle class and the bourgeois class. And I think for a lot of people, when they think about like power, state power, they automatically think of like elections and candidates and having, you know, different seats in government. And you kind of mentioned how it doesn't have to be through elections or electoralism. So how does an organization or a party grapple with like the task of taking state power in other ways besides elections?
It would help if you go back and look at this country before the Russian Revolution. One of our problems on the left is that everyone keeps thinking about October 1917, where it went wrong or where it was right. And they forget that there was a mass democratic socialist movement in this country under Eugene Debs from the turn of the century, about 1900, through 1917, when you had the international split with the Soviet Revolution. That was a mass party we had. It was an American party. We had no foreign example to guide us. And we should go back and look at that, both the weakness and the strength. We thought then we could build a third party. That was the whole point. Turns out that's harder to do than we think. But you can certainly build local groups. You can win members of Congress and hold on to those seats. If you think about the Socialist Party in Milwaukee, we had the mayor of Milwaukee from 1948 to 52. I've forgotten.
Mm-hmm.
But Frank Zeider was a very good guy. Not a revolutionist, but a very good guy.
Socialist, right?
Pardon?
Socialist, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
A devout Lutheran, religious, not a Marxist. Frank was a very sharp guy, and he was the mayor of Milwaukee for, I think, three terms at the height of McCarthy. So he proved you can do it. You had no national party to back him. The party in Wisconsin was its own thing and was able to get him in power. Couldn't carry on after him because times were changing. But you've gone quiet, Shaman. What happened to you?
Well, I think he wanted the water. I think the water placated Shaman.
You got drunk on the water, Shaman?
So speaking of the Eugene Debs party, do you think that, you know, being a third party was a mistake for the Eugene Debs party? I mean, obviously they had a crack up after 1917. That was kind of, it was difficult to respond to the October Revolution. Eugene Debs himself said he was a Bolshevik, but not everybody agreed, and so there were splits, and that seemed to have precipitated kind of its failure. But do you think it was a mistake for them to be a third party?
Well, looking back, there are lots of reasons for what happened. Not just the division between the socialists and the communists in 1917, but the fact the Socialist Party opposed World War I. But World War I was a very popular war. It may have been the most popular war we ever fought. People didn't play Bach or Beethoven because it was German. Sauerkraut was called, what was it called? I forget, but sauerkraut wasn't called sauerkraut. And there's a whole weird identification with the total patriotic war to end all wars, a war to make the world safe for democracy. And I think the Socialist Party lost some appeal because it really had opposed the war. Our people went to prison because of it, including Debs. And while that's a great part of our history, it also didn't help us win a lot of people. Plus, the Russian Revolution led to the kind of McCarthyite phase of 1920-21, the Palmer raids on the aliens and on left organizations that occurred. So I don't think you can blame it on the party. I think you have to look at the political context. And I think, although I'm not a good academic, I think that Debs, by the end of the 1920s, had decided we needed a Labour Party, not a Socialist Party. And the Socialist Party never really went in that direction. You ended up with Norman Thomas, a one-man movement, in a sense. Not really the leader of a mass party.
The way that Eugene Debs was. So, I guess, maybe, let me see what time it is. Maybe we can kind of start to wrap things up, because I don't want to keep you too long. But one thing I did want to ask you is, you know, if there was any sort of advice that you would have for people who want to be socialists today, or who want to make socialism today, if there's anything that you think, you know, they need to keep in mind or learn.
Yeah, I think you should read the Debs biography, The Bending Cross, which is a great biography of Debs. I think back in print, not dogmatic, but very good, very moving. I think, problem is I'm not a good reader. There's a wealth of literature in the socialist movement. I would ask someone who's academic what they would recommend to read. I would be very cautious of the groups that have a Trotskyist tradition. I found them very difficult to work with and very inclined to split over the slightest disagreement, to have the perfect line. And you're never going to have the perfect line. So I can't be much help there.
Do the Trotskyist groups still tend to split all the time? Do the Trotskyist groups still tend to split all the time?
Yes, they do.
Okay.
If there's a parallel, it should be to the Christian Church, where for all of the faults of the Catholic Church, there was really just that one split of Luther. But the Catholic Church has remained steady, unified. It's there for 2,000 years, still there, ups and downs, good and bad, corrupt and saintly, it's there. But Martin Luther, in breaking, set in motion the concept that it was okay to question the authority of the church, which meant you could question Luther, which meant if you look at the Christian faith, there are a dozen divisions within Christianity, which were possible because of Martin Luther's split with the Roman Catholic Church. And the Trotskyists tend to take that position literally. I mean, if you can break with Moscow, which they did, very courageous of them, they deserve a lot of credit for that. But once you can do that, then everything is up for grabs. and you lose sight of the importance of maintaining some kind of united movement. Put up with a lot, but maintain some sense of a united movement, because we have nothing else. We have no army, we have no newspaper, we have no radio. And it's very important for us to have a comradely sense that dominates the movement, rather than a search for the perfect answer. There is no perfect answer. And the Trotskyists will keep on sitting forever. There are maybe 24 international Trotsky movements today, which is silly, but they're there. And they will keep on splitting. And they will carry that into any group they go into. They will try to seize the leadership of the group to make it the vanguard group. And my life experience has been the communists are easy to work with, by and large, compared to the Trotskyists. The communists have a good sense of the mass. Trotskyists don't. And I don't either. I remember we had a meeting once to discuss how to organize to fight the raising of the subway fare. And I said, we ought to organize a campaign around a no-fare subway, a free subway. But an old guy present said, and he clearly had to be either out of the Communist Party or out of the Socialist Party, because he said, no, you can't say a free subway. People will think you're nuts. You can say, don't raise the fare. They will understand. He grasped immediately what made a mass movement possible, a demand that was achievable, not a man that was perfect and good, right, but an achievable demand. Don't raise the fare. Whereas my position was abolish the fare. Great position. But everyone who really was working for a living and scraping to get by says, well, I don't have time for that. I want to keep the fare where it is. Do you see what I'm... It's a delicate issue, but you have to think, where are the mass of people? What are they going to put up with? And the old communist and socialist movements had a good sense of the mass. The Trotskyists don't have that sense. They tend to be to look for more perfect, correct, idealistic, utopian solutions. And there is a paradox, because we need to have the utopian solution put forward within the movement always, but it's not an immediate demand.
So how do you connect the immediate demands that people, you know, like agree with these, you know, the utopian demands that...
Very hard. That's up to you to work out. I have no
okay.
idea.
We'll do our best.
Yeah, we'll do our best.
What?
We'll do our best.
We'll do our best.
I'm sort of throwing it back at you because...
No, it's okay.
No, yeah, it's a hard question, I guess. I mean...
There is a value to the radical position. Since I came out of the War Resisters League and the pacifist movement, which is based on absolute values and absolute resistance to military service, for example, I think that that movement has a very important prophetic role to play. The Catholic Worker, which is a couple of blocks away, and I have friends in it, some of whom just got arrested and face a year in prison, they have a prophetic role to play, as Dorothy Day did, in advocating a really total commitment to something.